Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 96-year-old Leroy Tucker of Madera, California, a veteran of the 332nd Field Artillery Battalion, part of the Black Hawk Division, the 86th Infantry Division in World War II. After initially receiving a deferment for the important work of milking cows on his uncle's dairy, he chose the Army over the Navy, in part because he didn't know how to swim. His first experience ever on a ship was his voyage to Europe in early 1945.
When we got on the ship, it was, I think, 5,000 troops on that one ship. It was a big ocean liner built in the Netherlands someplace over there. It was a beautiful ship, a passenger liner. Well, that's why we went to the English Channel on it. They wouldn't let nobody go outside to even smoke cigarettes on it because them subs were out there all around trying to get close enough to get a shot at that ship with all the guys on there. And we'd have to stand guard duty and open the doors and let them out on deck, the guys that were on the ship. Then we'd close the door and then let them out the other door. We'd work all night like that. And when we got just to going into the English Channel, the ship we was on blew a head gasket on one engine, and that slowed it down. Them subs was trying to get a close enough where they could get a shot at it, but our destroyers and all of them were out there dropping depth charges, and you could feel the every time one of them depth charges go off, you that old size of that old ship would just feel like it was shaking like that. They were pretty darn close out there when they could do that.
So. I guess so.
Yeah.
So that's quite a show that you're taking in there.
Yeah.
Although I don't know how entertaining it is when your life could be the price for it.
I don't know. Don't seem like anybody ever thought too much like that. It might happen, but it could happen, and I guess it did happen in some times.
And the reason that your division, the 86th, was not sent initially to the Pacific was the Battle of the Bulge had been ongoing in Europe, and the casualty rate was such that they needed replacements and they needed more troops in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So you guys got rerouted to Europe. Were you ready for that? Were you prepared for what you were going to face?
We were pretty well knew what we was going for and everything like that. They'd told us a lot about what was to expect and everything. And so we were pretty well up on what we was up against out there. And luckily, my story was that I'd heard is the Germans had took a lot of prisoners and they had them loaded on a truck and they pulled down into the forest where like a big meadow in there, and they had these guys all get out and told them they was going to get ready to take them over to a concentration camp while they couldn't take care of them. They'd have Germans were on the move, you know, at the Battle of Bulge there. And then when they got them out there in the forest all lined up, they pulled a truck in there with a machine gun sitting up in the back of it with covered with a canvas, and they just threw the canvas off and started, those guys seen, picked up on what was happening, and they all scattered and run into the timber, and some of them got away and got up to worked their way around to Bastogne and told those guys what had happened, and that's why they really told that German officer when he went up there and told him to surrender. They told him, you know, what to do.
The famous quote was nuts.
Yeah.
So that's nuts. I'm not going to surrender.
That's what they said to him.
Yeah. So you guys are hearing these kind of stories of how the Germans had treated some American prisoners.
Yeah.
So you definitely don't want to be taken prisoner.
Right.
But there were even worse things than being taken prisoner. Was that a consideration on your part? Did you ever wonder, hey, am I ever gonna go back home and see my family again?
Oh, yeah. Sometimes, like a night, they called on a telephone. The infantry was up ahead of us, maybe a couple miles or something, always shooting whatever they called for, to knock out a machine gun nest or something. They would come on the telephone, said, everybody be on the alert. You gun crews, there's a report of a German patrol out, patrolling that area. I said, it wasn't just a few minutes after that, they were firing some big lights up in the sky. They just light up the whole group country around there, them flares, you know, they'd put up there. And we'd put some of them up there, and some of our guys that had to do duty, like one guy from Kentucky, we had the weapons carrier, you know, and had a 50 caliber machine gun with a circle on top of it up here to where they could move it around all the way around.
Sure.
Well, it was so dark you couldn't see your head like that. But he said I was up on that machine gun, and the order come over to be on the alert. And then he said somebody told me that a machine gun man on the machine gun didn't last over 3 seconds in combat. And he said, I was just about ready to crawl off of him and take off running. But that's just the way he talked, you know. So we always got a kick out of him.
Well, let's talk about how your job worked. Field artillery, there's a few different weapons they would employ. Mm-hmm. Did you have to train on all of them or just specifically
We had to, everybody had to take the training, like in case something happened to you, why somebody else would just take over.
Because you're shelling them from a distance and they're trying to figure out where those shells are coming from and lobbing them right back at you.
We had a little spotter plane, only one. I think it could have landed in my backyard here. But we could see, but a lot of times going back and forth, you know, and the infantry would call in, we need some help over here. This machine gun is knocking the heck out of us. Well, this little guy would get up there and he'd be moving back and forth. And once in a while, you'd see a black puff of smoke from an 88. Would hit pretty close to him and just have a puff of black smoke there. And you see him go like that. Pretty soon you hear him come back up again. And we always got a kick out of watching him do it. He never did get a hit.
And you mentioned how you have to know every position on that 105 in case something happens to one of the other guys on your crew. Mm-hmm. But how many people does it take to operate one of those 105 millimeters, and what are the different jobs?
We had about 10 people all together. Then we had the sergeant. He took care of everybody, I guess, and told them what to do and when to fire and all that kind of stuff. We'd cover the telephones from one gun to the next. They'd call the infantry guys. They'd call us, and he'd tell that little guy up there in that airplane and tell us to fire one round a certain place, and we'd fire a round out there, and then he'd take the reading off of that, and then he'd start us telling us where to far and on, just like fence posts, you know. And first thing you know, one last shell would land right on top of that machine gun. That'd be the end of the nest.
So what was your specific job on that gun crew?
I'd open the breech, and some of the other guys on it would stick a shell in there. The shells are about that long. And
3 feet long?
Yeah, something like that. They were just like a rifle shell, only bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd come separated where the projectile was over here and the casing was laying here. They'd calculate how far it was over there and everything, and then they'd tell us where it was. And then our job was some Wiley's from Vicelli. He was good at figures real fast because he was a cab driver. He could make money change. So he was on the gun sight on the aiming stakes. We had two aiming stakes back there, but they'd line up with that sight on the gun. And on my side, I was on most of the time was where the elevation and the deflection this way, and then pull the trigger when they say fire.
So you didn't have to point it or train it. You open the breech, and then you're the one pulling the trigger.
As the gun come in recoil, I'd reach out and grab the knob here and do it like that, and he'd kick the empty out on the ground, and one of the other guys that'd be standing there was the one to go in. And at one time, they told us if we had rapid fire, that we could have with a certain distance, whatever we was firing out there, that we could have 5 or 6 shells in the air before the first one hit the ground from one gun.
Wow.
And you'd take a battery of 4 guns, you could just see what kind of a pattern that hit when it hit the ground. One time a German officer we'd captured, he told our Captain Knapp from Los Angeles, was our captain. They said, it's only one thing worse than I can think of. And the captain said, what was that? He could speak German to this guy anyway. He said, is that damn American artillery? It was worse than the German chow.
Uh-huh. It's quite a reputation to uphold.
Yeah.
So by the time you get over there, the Battle of the Bulge is over. That penetration has been repelled.
Right.
But there was still work to be done to finish this war off.
We just turned right around and hit the main highway, Autobahn, and headed toward Germany to Cologne. A lot of times there'd be a 9th Army or somebody over here need some help. We'd be close by, and we'd line up and help them out a little bit. Stuff like that. And one place there, we come up and they'd pulled us all off of the highway, and they said they'd had a mix-up, but the signs, they'd found out we was on the wrong, getting on the wrong road. Mm-hmm. We was moving up. They'd found out that the Germans had come in during the night and sneaked in there and changed the signs on the posts, on the road signs, pointing in the wrong direction. And that's when first time I'd seen General Patton. He come by in a Jeep standing up we pulled off on the narrow road, you know, and he come by and his Jeep standing up with the windshield up. He's standing up on it, looking all around. When he come by, he gives a salute and had that little QWERTY always carried with him like this.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only time I ever saw him.
And as far as, you know, the role that you guys played in the artillery, did you get a perspective on how significant your role was and what you meant to the bigger picture?
Like at Remagen, they wanted that bridge so bad across the Rhine River. It was about 10 miles from Cologne, if I remember right. We got up close enough where we could kind of, our tanks and everything had got up there and kept the Germans from coming across, but they wanted to blow that bridge so we couldn't get across. So they sent some of their people that does that job for them, you know, blows up bridges, set explosives all over that bridge, and when they went to set them off, some of them went off and some of them didn't, left the bridge standing. And our engineers got in there and repaired it pretty quick so we could get our tanks and all that stuff across. And we could sit over there, and any time they tried to send in reinforcements, our little guy was up there pointing them out for us. And we're sitting on the other side, far and across the river, keeping them from bringing in stuff.
So your 105-millimeter howitzers were shelling the spot where they were trying to get reinforcements.
Coming up the road with convoys, you know, with supplies and stuff. And we just keep them at bay. They couldn't get to the bridge. And then in one mountain area there, they sneaked back across the river and set up a machine gun right across the river from where we had our guns lined up, 1, 2, 3, 4 in a row. From our gun, looking across them, we could see tracer bullets coming across the river to the number one gun down here, 2, 3, till one of them guys got beat on him over there with a round of 105, and that was the end of the machine gun over there. Yeah.
Well, that's got to be a little hair-raising, too.
Yeah. You couldn't believe anybody would be that brave to go set up a machine gun right there practically in daylight and start shooting right across the river at you, but they did.
What was the range on those guns? How far away would you be?
We had a charge 1 to 10 powder bags. You know, little bag,
mm-hmm.
And they'd call down like be 3 miles over there, maybe be charge 4, charge 5. But if it's far, as far as you could fire, it'd be charge 10. I'd say we'd probably go 5 or 6 miles or something like that up for past where the infantry was dug in and stuff like that.
And were there different kinds of shells that you guys used?
Yeah. We had high explosives, and or we had time shells where you could dial them. If you wanted it to explode 10 feet above the ground or 30 feet or even in the air, if you were shooting at a plane or something, you could dial it where that when that thing exploded, it would be so high above the ground. And, poset fuses, I think, is what they call them, made out of plastic. And one of the other guys that took care of our shells, putting them together while we was firing, well, they'd call on his telephone there and tell him what charge to use and everything, and they'd relay it back to us, or the sergeant would.
Well, and you've hit on that communication aspect a few times here. You talked about your spotter plane. I'm sure there are forward observers as well. You're coordinating with the infantry units, and there's something significant you want to avoid, which is hitting your own guys. And that was a major risk of this,
yeah.
Right?
See, the most of our shells were made were so many seconds after it left the barrel of the gun. If there was something wrong with it, it'd explode, but it'd be already out there far enough where it didn't any nothing come back up.
Mm-hmm.
We had SEALs in front of us, too, to help somebody sniping at you or something like that. That old gun the Germans had, they could use it as anti-aircraft shell gun or just artillery, too. That 88, but it had to have like a rifle shooting, you know. Where with this old howitzer, we could sit over there behind a hill somewhere and shoot up and over and come right down on top of them. Some places we'd go by, like some of their concentration camps, where we'd make them turn loose all any prisoners they had, and they wouldn't be very well taken care of. There'd be skin and bones of guys where they wouldn't feed them very good and stuff like that. You know, it made you feel kind of bad to see it.
So you saw yourself some of these newly liberated prisoners who had been in concentration camps, because there are still people today, not that many of them, but some of them, who try to say that didn't happen, the Holocaust isn't real.
Right.
But you saw with your own eyes some of the people who had survived somehow
pretty sad to see people like that. They were just kind of like in a daze a little bit, some of them, you know, when you get close to them or something like that. Like they didn't have much to say or They were scared to say anything.
And you'd lived through plenty by this time. I mean, you went through the Great Depression here in the States, and you've seen dead people, dead animals, bomb craters, lots of destruction. I'm not trying to put thoughts in your head, but I'm wondering if even seeing prisoners like that helps you understand the purpose of you guys being over there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
If you guys aren't there, they're going to die in that concentration camp.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
It's time for another break, but there's more to come with 96-year-old Leroy Tucker, including the time he and a few others from his 105mm howitzer crew volunteered for infantry duty. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.